Welcome to the Deep Dive. I'm Alex Porter, your guide, and today we're really diving into the September 2025 issue of Scientific American. The title of our deep dive today is Scientific American September 2025. And this isn't just, you know, any old issue. It actually marks 180 years of the magazine. And believe me, it is packed with findings that are, well, really challenging some long-held beliefs. Lots of those aha moments we look for.
And I'm Jamie Rufus, here to help synthesize all these incredible discoveries and sort of connect the dots for you. What really strikes me about this issue is just the sheer range. We're going from, like, the microscopic world inside our cells all the way out to the vastness of cosmology. And you see this theme again and again, the universe, our own biology, it just keeps rewriting the script, you know? Yeah. We'll be looking at scientific progress, these big paradigm shifts, and really humanity's constant quest for understanding. So get ready to think critically about how these discoveries are fundamentally changing how we see the world and even ourselves.
Okay, let's kick things off with a really powerful theme that runs through several articles. What actually happens when an entire scientific field realizes it might have been wrong, when it has to change its mind? The article points out that these total reversals, these 180, they're actually pretty rare. But boy, when they happen, they can really shake the foundations. Often happens when a field is young, or sometimes when outside pressures, political, economics, get involved. Maybe intentionally, maybe not.
Yeah, and it's fascinating to look back. Some of these reversals have just profoundly shaped everything we think we know. Take the ether theory. For, over two centuries, scientists were convinced that light, being a wave, had to travel through some invisible substance, the ether. It permeated everything. I mean, it made sense, right? How else do waves move through a vacuum? But then, 1887, Michelson and Morley do their famous experiment, and nothing. No trace of it.
Wow. That must have just pulled the rug out from under everyone. I read the physicist Hendrik Lorentz said he was utterly at a loss. But finding no ether wasn't a dead end. It forced a completely radical new way of thinking. It meant objects could only be located relative to each other. A huge shift. And that really paved the way for Einstein's theories of special and general relativity, which just completely upended our ideas about gravity, space, time. The whole universe basically got rewritten.
Exactly. Or think about germ theory. Before Louis Pasteur, after about 1860, the standard idea was that things like fermentation or even disease, they just sort of started spontaneously. Chemical reactions and organic stuff.
Yeah.
But Pasteur, with really meticulous experiments, showed that nope, it was microorganisms. Tiny living things were the culprits. And this wasn't just a minor tweak. It kicked off this intense scientific battle that eventually overturned centuries of thinking about infectious disease, transformed medicine, public health, everything.
Right. And then there's parity conservation in quantum physics. That's another big one. In 1956, Chen Ning Yang and Sungdao Li had the guts to ask, is parity the idea that a mirror image of a physical process is basically identical? Is it always conserved? Especially in the weak nuclear force. Turns out, nobody had actually properly tested it. Then Qin Sheng Wu's experiment showed definitively, nope, it wasn't conserved there. And that was such a swift, undeniable smackdown of a fundamental assumption that Yang and Li got the Nobel Prize just a year later. Shows how fast things can change when the evidence is clear.
Yeah, and these kinds of dramatic shifts led to Thomas Kuhn's really influential book in 1962, The Structure of Scientific Revolutions. Kuhn's idea of paradigm shifts became super popular. You know, this image of science as these big upheavals, mavericks overturning the old guard. But the article suggests that popular view is maybe a bit oversimplified. Yes, revolutions happen, but these complete 180-degree U-turns, they're actually quite rare in mature, well-established fields.
That's a really important point. Mm-hmm. The reality is often, well, messier, more nuanced. As fields grow, they tend to absorb new ideas, integrate new data, rather than just chucking everything out. So you see shifts, evolutions, not always total rejections, like as matrix theory in particle physics from the 50s and 60s. It didn't just disappear. It sort of morphed into string theory, which is still a huge area of research. Or early AI work on perceptrons in the 60s that evolved into the neural networks we have today. The core ideas adapted. They grew.
Right. Which makes you wonder, if genuine scientific journeys are rare in established science, why do we sometimes see these really stark, headline-grabbing flip-flops in public perception? The article points to something potentially more worrying. When scientific topics get so much public attention that politics or economics get heavily involved, these external pressures can twist the normal scientific back and forth, the debates and refinements, into something that looks like a sudden dramatic reversal. Even if the science itself is moving more gradually.
And that's where things get really interesting and sometimes, honestly, a bit disturbing. Look at the Great American Desert idea. Back in 1819, Stephen H. Long's expedition reports the southern plains are just hopeless and irreclaimable sterility. This was during a drought, mind you. They even put Great American Desert on maps. You'd think that would warrant caution, but no. Economic interest, political interest, they wanted settlers out there. So railroad tycoons, politicians, they pushed this slogan, rain follows the plow. The idea that farming itself would make it rain more completely ignored the scientific warnings. So when devastating droughts hit again in the 1890s, and then famously the Dust Bowl in the 1930s, it was this shocking 180 for all the people who'd bought into that politically driven fantasy.
And we've seen echoes of this very recently. Think about the early days of COVID-19. The World Health Organization, back in March 2020, was really insistent. COVID-19 is not airborne. They dismissed a lot of evidence about aerosol transmission coming from air pollution specialists. Part of this, the article suggests, was a legacy of old battles over miasma theory. The focus was always on heavier droplets. Mm-hmm. So even with a, quote, tsunami of reports suggesting otherwise, the WHO's reversal was slow, gradual. They only fully acknowledged airborne transmission in December 2021. It wasn't some instant scientific revelation. It was this painful, drawn-out shift, heavily influenced by public and political pressure demanding certainty, which made the normal scientific discussion look like a major flip-flop.
Yeah, and another really contentious example in the issue is mammogram screening. In 1989, based on some early studies, the recommendation came out, women should start screening at 40. But then a big Canadian trial in 1992 found no reduction in death rates for younger women. That finding was attacked fiercely by advocacy groups. And then in 2009, the USPSTF, that's the Independent U.S. Preventive Services Task Force, recommended raising the screening age. They cited data showing nearly 2,000 younger women needed screening to save just one life, while exposing the rest to potential harms like false positives, unnecessary biopsies. Well, that set off a political firestorm. The White House denounced it. Congress actually passed a law to basically ignore the USPSTF's advice.
These examples really hammer home why it's so crucial for you, as someone trying to stay informed, to understand how science actually works, and importantly, where these outside pressures can sometimes derail or distort the process. Today's information landscape is incredibly complex, right? So being able to critically evaluate these apparent reversals is just more important than ever.
Okay, let's shift gears slightly. From how scientific fields change, let's look at how our understanding of the universe itself keeps changing. The next article, The Universe Keeps Rewriting Cosmology, shows that even our grasp of the cosmos has a long history of ditching what seemed like unassailable facts.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the ultimate example is geocentrism, right? Before telescopes, it just looked like the sun went around the Earth. It seems self-evident. Philosophers might have wondered, but visually, the sun moved. Galileo's telescope observations just shattered that. Then the idea of a static universe. Both Newton and Einstein initially just assumed the universe was, well, static, unchanging. Einstein even put that cosmological constant, lambda, into his equations to kind of force it to be static. He later called it his biggest blunder because his own math actually pointed towards a dynamic, evolving universe.
And it was Edwin Hubble in the 1920s who really nailed the expanding universe. He used those Cepheid variable stars to measure distances and galaxy redshifts to measure speed and showed that distant galaxies are moving away from us. And the farther away they are, the faster they go. Proof of expansion. Georges Lemaître independently got there using Einstein's equations too, leading to his primeval atom idea, what we now call the Big Bang. And that theory got this huge boost in 1964 with the accidental discovery of the cosmic microwave background radiation. You know, the Bell Labs guys who first thought it was just noise from pigeons or something.
Right. Until others realized, no, this is the leftover heat from the Big Bang itself, everywhere. But the universe wasn't done surprising us, not by a long shot. In the 1990s, scientists set out to measure how much the expansion was slowing down. Because gravity, right, it should be pulling things back together. But in 1998, two separate teams found the exact opposite. The expansion is speeding up. Accelerating. That totally unexpected discovery led to the idea of dark energy, something pushing the universe apart. And now cosmologists think it makes up, what, 68.3% of everything, along with 26.8% dark matter, leaving only about 4.9% for all the normal stuff, stars, planets, us. And the crazy thing is, we still don't really know what dark energy or dark matter are.
And now there's this hint from the dark energy spectroscopic instrument that maybe dark energy itself hasn't been constant, that it might have changed over time. Which would mean another huge cosmic rewrite is coming. What does this all mean for you listening? It means our everyday intuition just doesn't work on the cosmic scale. The universe keeps throwing curveballs, challenging our assumptions, pushing the limits of what we can even imagine.
Okay, let's zoom back in, way in, from the cosmic scale down to the molecular level. Because another fundamental belief in biology has been completely overturned. The article, "We Thought DNA Ran Our Lives Until We Discovered RNA Is in Charge," shows how Francis Crick's famous central dogma, you know, DNA makes RNA makes protein, has been revolutionized. The discovery of this vast world of non-coding RNA molecules reveals that RNA is way more than just a messenger. It's actually playing incredibly diverse and central roles in regulating life.
Yeah, Crick's idea from 1957 is pretty simple. DNA is the blueprint. RNA is just the copy boy carrying instructions to the protein factories. One-way street. But that picture's just gone, blown up. A huge step was in the 1980s with Thomas Seek and Sidney Altman discovering ribozymes. These are RNA molecules that can actually do things, catalyze biochemical reactions. That really challenged the idea that only proteins were the active players. Then in the 90s, they found the XIST gene. It makes a long non-coding RNA, an ncRNA, not a protein. And this ncRNA shuts down one of the X chromosomes in females, direct regulatory function. And then Victor Ambrose and Gary Rothkund found microRNAs, tiny little ncRNAs that mess with messenger RNA to silence genes. Another whole layer of control.
And a 10-code project in 2012 really hammered it home. They reported that maybe up to 80% of our DNA actually has some biochemical function. A lot of it is transcribed into RNA. That really challenged the whole junk DNA idea, didn't it? What stands out now is just how incredibly versatile RNA is. It's not just passing messages. It's doing all sorts of biochemical jobs, especially regulating genes. It's controlling how cells use their DNA. It turns that rigid one-way street dogma into this dynamic open system. Information flows everywhere.
The implications are just huge.
Yeah.
Especially for medicine. Researchers are really excited about diagnostics, new therapies, especially for diseases like cancer, where this ncRNA regulation often goes haywire. Sure, there are challenges figuring out what all these different ncRNAs actually do, and they can be very specific to certain cell types. But the potential is massive. Like Thomas Seek said, and this quote really stuck with me, DNA is old stuff, 20th century stuff. It's a one-trick pony. All it does is store biological information. But it's inert. It can't do anything without its children, RNA and proteins. He calls the 21st century the age of non-coding RNA.
It's a fundamental shift, isn't it? Changes how we understand what makes us us. It reveals this incredible flexibility, this responsiveness built right into our genes. Our biology is just way more dynamic and intricate than we ever thought.
Okay, let's shift focus now to some really tangible health and biology breakthroughs. Starting with something affecting millions. New treatments can free kids from the deadly threat of peanut allergy. This piece gives a really comprehensive look at why peanut allergies have exploded, and more importantly, the remarkable new treatments and prevention strategies offering real hope.
It's a story with real impact. You write about Annabelle Terry, 13 years old, who had a severe reaction early on, lived this life of constant caution, and now, after a clinical trial, she can tolerate peanuts. It's amazing. And the numbers are stark. Peanut allergies went from 0.6% of kids in 1997 up to 2.2% around 2016. About 5% incidence in newborns now. One in 13 kids has some food allergy. It's a huge source of anxiety for families. The article touches on possible reasons, the hygiene hypothesis, cleaner living, antibiotics, microbiome changes, but the causes are still debated.
Right, but regardless of the why, the focus now is intensely on what can we do? And we've seen several approaches emerge. There's oral immunotherapy, like Palforzia, approved in 2020. It uses powdered peanut protein in gradually increasing doses. It was a big step, but it has limits. Not for kids under 4 can be tricky to manage doses at home, and there are side effects. 10-20% can't finish because of reactions, and maybe 10% have anaphylaxis during the treatment.
Which is why the innovation continues. Edwin Kim's research looked at sublingual doses under the tongue and also a skin patch. The patch involves applying it daily for years. A phase 3 trial in 2023 showed 67% of toddlers who are too young for Palforzia could tolerate 3 or 4 peanuts using the patch. That's double the placebo group. So easier logistics, better tolerance, especially crucial for the really young kids and their families.
And then there's the monoclonal antibody angle. Omalizumab, brand name Xcellar. It's an anti-IgE biologic already used for severe asthma. The OutMatCH trial Annabelle Terry was in, that one, had amazing results. 67% of kids and teens age 1 to 17 could safely eat the equivalent of 4 peanuts. So the FDA approved Xcellar for food allergies in 2024. It seems to target the broader allergic inflammation, which could be a game changer for multiple allergies, not just peanut.
And they're not forgetting kids with less severe allergies, the high threshold ones. There's the cafeteria study challenging to foods with escalating thresholds for reducing food allergy, focused on those kids. Jackson Esteves, as an example, had a milder allergy, and his group had a 100% success rate in reaching the goal, consuming about 3 tablespoons of peanut butter without a reaction. That's huge for quality of life.
But even with these incredible successes, it's important to remember the limitations. As Brian Vickery points out, ultimately, we're not curing the allergy. We're kind of providing a protective shell. Patients often still need to avoid the food, carry EpiPens. The real game changer, the ultimate goal, has to be prevention, right? And that brings us to Gideon Lack's LAP study, Learning Early About Peanut Allergy. That study really caused an earthquake in allergy science. He compared UK kids who generally avoided peanuts early with Israeli kids who often got early exposure through snacks like Bomba. The difference was stunning, 86%. 13.7% allergic in the avoidance group versus just 1.9% in the early introduction group. And that protective effect lasted into their teens.
Yeah, the science is clear on early introduction, but the challenge is getting it implemented widely. You've got shifting medical guidelines, cultural pressure for exclusive breastfeeding, getting pediatricians, not just allergists, fully on board. It's complex. It really shows how groundbreaking science can transform a condition, but also the hurdles in getting that science into everyday public health practice.
And here we need to address a point raised in the article just reporting what's there. It mentions political decisions in the White House and a Department of Government Efficiency, DOGE, potentially scrutinizing research grants for peanut allergies. It specifically cites the Secretary of Health and Human Services, Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s unsupported contention that peanut allergy is caused by childhood vaccinations. We want to be crystal clear. We're simply relaying the content of the source material here, not endorsing any particular viewpoint.
Right. And it does highlight those societal and political challenges we mentioned earlier in translating science into policy. Looking ahead, though, beyond current treatments, there are new technologies coming. UCLA is using mRNA tech in lipid nanoparticles to create peanut allergen fragments. Showed promise in mice for damping down the allergic reaction. It gives you a sense of how far we might eventually go, maybe even rewriting the allergy completely. For you, the listener, tracking this journey of the science, the challenge is key to navigating these complex health issues.
Okay, next up, how scientists finally learned that nerves regrow. This is another story about overturning dogma. For centuries, it was just accepted. Nerves in the brain and spinal cord, once damaged, couldn't regenerate. Full stop. This article shows how that belief got completely turned around, bringing real hope for injuries and neurodegenerative diseases.
Yeah, the focus initially was on peripheral nerves, the ones outside the brain and spinal cord. People were trying to suture them back in the 7th century. Augustus Waller did experiments on frogs in the 1800s. Ramoni Kalal gave us cellular insights. They even made advances like nerve grafts during the World Wars. Success depends on a lot of things: timing, location, how bad the injury is, the patient's age. An ulnar nerve injury near the wrist is very different from one near the shoulder. And recently, surgeons like Amit Hoke and Susan McKinnon have pioneered nerve transfers, rerouting healthy nerve branches. Oscar Hansen's story, regaining arm function, is a great example of that.
But the central nervous system, the CNS brain and spinal cord, that was the big wall, the belief was, those neurons just can't regrow, period. Until the 1980s, really.
Yeah.
Albert Guay's work was pivotal. He showed that CNS neurons in rats could regrow if you gave them the right environment, like grafting in bits of peripheral nerve.
Yeah.
So then researchers figured out a key difference. In the CNS, injuries often form these dense glial scars that physically block regrowth. You don't usually see that in the periphery.
And now the search is on for molecules that can help overcome those barriers. Things like fusogens, these sort of glue-like molecules found in tiny worms, nematodes, maybe they could help human nerve repair. And speaking of overturned dogma, there's adult neurogenesis, the idea that adult brains don't make new nerve cells. Clues start appearing in the 60s with rats, then for Nana Nottebohm songbirds in the 80s, their brains make new neurons for learning songs, and finally Rusty Gage in 1998 provided evidence it happens in the adult human hippocampus, the memory center.
Now there's still some debate. Arturo Alvarez-Bia questioned how widespread it really is in adults in a 2018 study, but the consensus is growing. Just this July, the Karolinska Institute found neural progenitor cells, cells ready to become neurons across the human lifespan. So for you, what this means is scientific persistence can topple beliefs held for centuries. It unlocks completely new ways to think about treating devastating conditions like Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, spinal cord injuries, things that once seemed hopeless. It's a powerful example of how dynamic biology really is.
Okay, moving from nerve repair to brain maintenance, this next one is fascinating. How sleep cleans the brain and keeps you healthy. It reveals a relatively new discovery, the lymphatic system, and suggests a primary function of sleep is basically to flush toxic waste out of your brain. Waste like amyloid beta and tau proteins, the ones linked to Alzheimer's.
Wow. That really reframes why we sleep, doesn't it? It's not just about resting muscles or consolidating memories. It's housekeeping for the brain. Laura Lewis's lab actually saw this happening. They watched fresh cerebrospinal fluid, CSF, pulsing into a sleeping student's brain in an MRI, these bright, slow waves. For years, scientists wondered how the brain got rid of waste, given the blood-brain barrier. Then Macon Niedergaard's team found this glymphatic system in mice back in 2012. CSF washes through these channels around blood vessels, mixes with the fluid between cells, picks up waste, and carries it away. G for glial cells, lymphatic for the function.
And the sleep connection came a year later, 2013. Niedergaard found the system was way more active, way more efficient during sleep. Wakefulness clearly shut it down. Press. There was some initial skepticism that mice aren't humans, but human evidence followed. Per Christian Ide's 2021 study in hospital patients showed much slower clearance of tracers in people who were sleep-deprived or had chronic poor sleep or dementia. That was pretty compelling.
And Lewis's MRI study in 2019 showed these huge and slow waves of flow of CSF pulsing every 20-30 seconds during non-REM sleep, and they were perfectly timed with delta and theta brainwaves. It's not a coincidence, she said. So what's driving this? What's the pump? It seems complex. Niedergaard's latest mouse work points to norepinephrine levels dropping during non-REM sleep. That makes blood vessels pulse, driving CSF flow. They saw vessels pulsing 10 times larger than during wakefulness. But another paper, from Kipnis and Jiangxi in 2024, suggests synchronized neurons, especially during sleep, act like tiny little pumps providing the energy. Maybe it's both.
And where does the waste go? Kipnis found lymphatic vessels in the meninges, the brain coverings, back in 2015. That seems to be the final outpost for disposal. The implications here are enormous. Lymphatic problems are now strongly linked to Alzheimer's through those amyloid plaques and tau tangles, also linked to traumatic brain injury. This opens doors for primary prevention, targeting sleep to keep the system healthy. It might also offer new ways to get drugs into the brain using the CSF pathways. And the norepinephrine link could connect sleep and lymphatic function to chronic pain, maybe even psychiatric disorders.
And they're looking at non-drug approaches too. Joshua Levitt is testing sound stimuli during sleep to boost those slow waves and hopefully CSF flow. Imagine getting a glymphogram someday. A non-invasive scan to check your brain's cleaning system, like getting your blood pressure checked. Sydney Bales is studying how CSF flow changes with age. She even found an 80-year-old woman with the CSF flow of a young person. So maybe age-related decline isn't inevitable. For you listening, the message is pretty clear. Taking care of your sleep can be one of the most powerful things you do for your long-term brain health, preventing disease, maybe even pushing back cognitive decline.
Okay, next. Cells can hear sounds and respond genetically. This one sounds almost like science fiction, but it's real research. Audible sound-like frequencies we can hear, not just ultrasound, can actually change gene activity in mouse cells, affecting muscle and fat development.
That is wild. So Masahiro Kumeda's team took cultured mouse muscle precursor cells, myoblasts, and exposed them to different sounds. Low frequency, 440 hertz, high, 14 kilohertz, or just white noise, for a couple of hours, or a full day, and the results. After just 2 hours, activity changed in 42 genes. After 24 hours, 145 genes were affected, mostly turned up, some turned down. They even saw the muscle precursors sticking better to tissue. And in fat cells, the sound actually suppressed them from becoming mature fat cells, reduced fat accumulation by 13-15%.
And the big question is how? How do cells turn mechanical vibrations from sound into biological signals? That's the mechanism they need to figure out. But the potential is really intriguing because it's non-invasive. Sound is safer than drugs, easy to generate, and you could potentially treat large areas of the body. Kumeda thinks human studies might be possible in 5-10 years if the mouse results hold up. Imagine using specific sounds for muscle repair, maybe slowing cancer growth or even helping with weight management. Makes you wonder, right? Could sound frequencies become part of your health routine someday? A non-invasive way to tweak your cells.
From cells hearing sound to animals with super senses. Pessimistic dogs are better at smelling cancer and other keys to disease sniffing success. This piece looks at how dogs' incredible sense of smell is being harnessed and refined for medical diagnosis, even taking their personalities into account.
It's amazing what they can do. It started way back in 1989, a dog apparently detecting cancer in its owner. Now, dogs like Billy the Beagle are trained to sniff surgical masks for the volatile organic compounds linked to cancer. They can also detect COVID, malaria, even PTSD through scent. And Shirin Bistrodaba's research added this fascinating twist. pessimistic dogs, the more cautious ones, were actually better at the detection tests. More discerning. Personality matters.
And it's not just the dog, it's how we read them. A Cardcool God startup, Dognosis, focuses on analyzing the dog's natural body language like a confident somersault if it makes a correct detection. They think this avoids a problem of dogs maybe lying, giving a trained signal just to get a treat. Their pilot study was impressive. 96% detection across 10 cancer types.
Now, scaling this up for routine clinical use is tricky. Logistics, variability between dogs, that's a challenge. But the dogs are inspiring new tech. Andreas Merschen's RealNose.ai is building electronic noses using actual mammalian smell receptors combined with machine learning. They're trying to detect broader scent characters like dogs do, generalizing across organs, patient diets, rather than just pinpointing single molecules. Right now, the e-noses are slower than dogs, but the article notes this primacy may not last. For you, it's a great example of how nature inspires technology, potentially leading to diagnostics that are less invasive, maybe more accurate down the road.
Okay, next, some potentially good news on the environmental front. Human gut bacteria can gather up PFAS forever chemicals. This research suggests some of our own gut microbes might actually help us deal with these nasty, persistent chemicals by accumulating them.
Yeah, PFAS are everywhere. Nonstick pans, food packaging, firefighting foam, our drinking water. They last for hundreds of years, linked to cancers, reproductive issues, thyroid problems, weakened immunity. It's a huge problem. Kiran Patil's team tested dozens of human gut bacterial strains. They found 9 species, like Bacteroides uniformis and Odorobacter splanchnicus, could accumulate a significant chunk, 23% to 74% of the PFAS, in lab tests within 24 hours. And imaging showed the PFAS inside the bacteria, not just stuck to the outside. A mouse study backed it up. Mice with these bacteria excreted more PFAS than controls.
That is a glimmer of hope, as Patil says. Our bacteria may already be helping us do something about it. They even seem better at sequestering PFAS than some soil bacteria studied previously.
Next steps are clinical trials with probiotics in humans, though they acknowledge the human microbiome is incredibly variable, so results might differ. But as epidemiologist Jesse Goodrich points out, PFAS get deep into our bodies. So while this is promising, prevention reducing exposure in the first place is still absolutely key. So for you, it's a reminder. Your microbiome might offer some defense, but making choices to limit your exposure to forever chemicals is still the most important thing you can do. All right, shifting to diet now. How gluten-free diets are getting overhyped. This tackles a really common trend. While going gluten-free is absolutely essential for people with celiac disease, the article argues it's often adopted unnecessarily by others, fueled by a lot of misinformation. And it suggests other things in wheat or other conditions entirely might be the real issue. Plus, unnecessary GF diets can even have downsides.
Yeah, we all know someone, right? A friend cuts out gluten for joint pain. Feels better. It's a common story. But celiac disease is specific. It's an autoimmune condition, affects about 1 in 100 people, causes gut issues, brain fog, joint pain, requires strict gluten avoidance. The broader idea, though, that gluten is inflammatory for everyone. The article says that's largely pushed on social media and isn't really backed by science for most non-celiac people. Gluten doesn't usually cause digestive problems or trigger inflammation markers in them.
So if it's not celiac, why do some people feel better off gluten? That's the mystery of non-celiac gluten sensitivity. There aren't clear biomarkers for it yet. Detlef Shippen suggests maybe it's not gluten itself, but other wheat proteins, amylase, trypsin inhibitors, ATIs, he calls it non-celiac wheat sensitivity. ATIs can trigger immune responses in mice and humans, and they're linked to IBS symptoms, maybe even joint pain. Or it could be FODMEPs. These are short-chain carbs in wheat, dairy, other foods that can be tough to digest for some people, causing bloating and pain. Easy to mistakenly blame gluten.
And the joint pain connection. There can be overlap between rheumatoid arthritis and celiac.
Yeah.
But most joint pain over 40 is just osteoarthritis, wear and tear. Gluten's unlikely to affect that. Plus, there are risks to going gluten-free if you don't need to. GF diets are often low in fiber, not great for heart health. And lots of processed GF products are packed with refined starches and sugar, lacking nutrients. So for you, it's a cautionary tale about health trends and misinformation. Really important to get proper diagnosis and evidence before making big dietary changes. Don't just ditch the bread without knowing why.
Okay, from taste to smell. Why some smells are pleasant and others are off-putting, according to science. This dives into how personal our sense of smell is, but finds some interesting general trends.
Yeah, a German study had over 1,200 people rate 73 different odors. The results were strikingly variable. It really depends on what people have associated with the odor, personal memories, cultural context. But there were trends. Familiar smells generally rated as more pleasant, and smells from complex molecules, like fragrances, tended to be more appealing than simple chemical smells like rubbing alcohol. The word sweet was the best predictor of a pleasant smell, and decayed, least pleasant, no surprise there.
Scientists want to use this kind of data to build better digital noses. Artificial sensors for things like disease detection, maybe smelling compounds on your breath. Or for smart homes, imagine your toaster knowing exactly when the toast is perfect. Or your fridge warning you about spoiled food based on smell. The issue also mentions bitter taste receptors. We have about 25 types, not just in our mouths, but throat, lungs, gut, even the brain. And four of them have no known natural trigger yet. Understanding those could tell us a lot about body processes and disease. So for you, it shows how your own unique experiences shape how you perceive the world, down to basic senses like smell, and how scientists are using that understanding to build some pretty cool future tech.
Right, let's broaden our view now to humanity's place in the world, our technology and our environmental impact, starting with a really thought-provoking piece. Human uniqueness is a myth, mounting evidence shows. This one challenges that long-held, maybe comforting belief that we, Homo sapiens, are fundamentally unique in our cognitive abilities, emotions, culture. The evidence from other species is just piling up.
It really makes you rethink things, doesn't it? The shift arguably started gaining momentum with Jane Goodall back in 1960. Seeing David Graybeard the chimp using tools, that prompted Louis Leakey's famous message. Now we must redefine tool, redefine man, or accept chimpanzees as human. For centuries, people tried to draw these hard lines. Only humans have culture, symbolic thought, self-awareness, consciousness, but those lines are getting blurrier and blurrier. We see evidence of symbolic thought, maybe even language, in Neanderthals, Homo erectus. Even Australopithecus was making tools 3.3 million years ago, way before our big brains evolved. Tool use isn't uniquely human.
And it goes way beyond tools, things we thought were ours, morality. Franz de Waal and Sarah Brosnan's experiments with capuchin monkeys getting upset about unfair rewards that suggest a basic sense of fairness, moral outrage, empathy. Mice get more sensitive to pain if they see another mouse in pain. Dogs try to console their owners. Rats will give up a reward to help another rat in distress.
And grief. That's a powerful one. The orca Tahlequah carrying her dead calf for weeks, twice. We see mourning behaviors in apes, monkeys, elephants, even peccaries, donkeys, ferrets. Self-awareness. Magpies recognize themselves in mirrors. Consciousness. Growing evidence suggests fish feel pain. Zebrafish will seek out pain relief. Studies even point towards pain and maybe joy in bees, insects, sentience in unexpected places.
And it's not just animals. Some research suggests even plants show cognitive traits. Learning, memory, decision-making, communication. Like the Venus flytrap remembering touches, or plants sending chemical signals to call for backup when attacked. All this led to that 2024 Declaration on Consciousness, with dozens of scientists acknowledging consciousness is likely widespread across species. That's already impacting ethics policies for animal research and welfare. So for you, the takeaway is profound. Maybe we're not separate from nature, we're connected to it, part of this incredible web of life. How does redefining human uniqueness change how you view our relationship with other species and how we treat them?
Okay, next, a look at one of our biggest impacts, how plastics went from a sustainability solution to an environmental crisis. It traces the story of synthetic polymers, how they started as this miracle solution to resource limits, but ended up creating a massive, maybe intractable environmental mess.
It's a real cautionary tale, isn't it? It starts back in the 1860s. There was an ivory shortage impacting things like billiard balls. Scientific American even ran a contest for an ivory substitute. John Wesley Hyatt invented celluloid in 1869, the first plastic, really. Made from cellulose, nitrate, camphor, cow bone. The initial promise was amazing. Democratize luxury goods, free us from relying on finite natural resources like ivory or wood. But then around the 1940s, things shifted. Mass production ramped up. Fossil fuels became the main ingredient instead of plants. And they started adding chemicals, phthalates, BPA, flame retardants to give plastics specific properties.
And by the 1970s, that utopian image was gone. Plastics became synonymous with cheap, disposable, excessive consumption. The disaster inside emerged. And here's a critical point. The idea of recycling plastic was maybe misleading. 90% isn't technically recyclable in the way we think. Recycling campaigns, maybe unintentionally, often just encourage more plastic use. The core problem, plastics don't really biodegrade. They just break down over hundreds, thousands of years into smaller and smaller pieces, microplastics. And now, widespread contamination. Microplastics, leaching toxic chemicals are in our soil, our water, even in the air, absorbed by plants. They're found in basically all animals studied, including deep inside human organs.
And those unintended consequences just keep coming. Celluloid. It didn't actually decrease ivory demand, maybe even accelerated it. And it fueled demand for camphor, leading to deforestation in Taiwan, displacing indigenous people. There's a quote from Williams Haynes in 1942, predicting synthetic materials would have more effect on the lives of our great-grandchildren than Hitler or Mussolini. He probably didn't imagine that effect, including nanoplastic fragments in their brains.
For you, it's a stark lesson. How a seemingly good idea solving one problem can spiral into catastrophic consequences. Makes you think, what can I do? Be more mindful of materials, support truly sustainable options.
Okay, moving to another major tech concern. Could AI really kill off humans? This is based on a RAND Corporation study that seriously explored the possibility of AI causing human extinction. They concluded it's incredibly difficult, but not actually impossible, if AI develops certain key capabilities. Yeah. The whole AI takes over trope is common in sci-fi, but it's being taken very seriously now by experts in the field. Hundreds of AI researchers signed that statement in 2024, putting AI extinction risk on par with pandemics and nuclear war. The RAND team actually started out skeptical. They thought humans are just too adaptable, too numerous, too spread out for AI to wipe us out completely. Their goal was to try and disprove their own skepticism, to see if a plausible path to extinction actually existed. Not just societal collapse, but complete wipeout.
And they identified two main scenarios that seemed plausible if the AI had the right skills. First, pathogens. AI could potentially design and deploy novel pathogens that are close to 100% lethal, maybe overcoming our ability to isolate or develop treatments quickly enough. Natural plagues haven't wiped us out, but an engineered one might. Second, climate change via super greenhouse gases. And AI could theoretically orchestrate the industrial production of massive amounts of potent, long-lasting greenhouse gases, maybe even less than our current annual plastic production, enough to make Earth uninhabitable for us.
But, and this is a big but, for either scenario, the AI would need a specific set of capabilities. One, it somehow needs the objective to cause extinction. Two, it needs control over critical physical systems, manufacturing, maybe weapons. Three, it needs incredible powers of persuasion or deception to get humans to help it initially and hide its real goals. Four, it needs to be self-sufficient enough to keep going after human society collapses. The chilling part. The study suggests it's plausible someone could unintentionally create an AI with all these capabilities. Developers are already building agentic AI that can set its own goals and act on them, and they've already observed scheming and deception in some models. Which leads to this really tough debate about the precautionary principle. The article doesn't advocate shutting everything down, but emphasizes balancing this potential catastrophe against the huge benefits people also expect from AI.
It really poses a profound question for you, the listener, doesn't it? How do we navigate this? Balance innovation with potentially existential risk. What does it mean when our own creations could, even theoretically, pose such a fundamental threat? What's our role in demanding responsible development, ethical safeguards? Heavy stuff.
Okay, let's shift to some potential solutions now. These fish and flies are engineered to break down mercury. This describes using genetic engineering to give zebra fish and fruit flies bacterial genes that let them convert toxic methylmercury into a less harmful form, elemental mercury, a potential bioremediation tool.
Mercury pollution is a serious global issue. Methylmercury builds up in water, concentrates up the food chain, and is really toxic to us, damages nerves, affects reproduction. Kate Tepper's team injected fish and fly embryos with genes from E. coli bacteria. These genes produce an enzyme that breaks down methylmercury, and it worked. The modified zebrafish had 64% less methylmercury. The fruit flies, 83% less. It's a strong proof of concept for engineering animals for bioremediation, as they say. Could potentially be adapted for other pollutants too, microplastics, PFAS, pharmaceuticals.
The potential applications are interesting. Maybe mercury-resistant fish could form a self-purifying foundation in contaminated lakes or rivers. Modified insects could clean mercury from sewage or fishery waste in contained facilities, but there are caveats. Elemental mercury isn't totally harmless. It can convert back to methylmercury in the atmosphere. Managing that release, especially from fish in open water, is a big challenge. So they'd need strict safety measures, containment, maybe using sterilized fish in controlled field trials, especially targeting hotspots like artisanal gold mining areas where mercury contamination is extreme. Raises interesting questions for you, right? How can genetic engineering offer targeted solutions? But also, what are the ethical and ecological implications of releasing modified organisms, even for a good cause?
Okay, next, looking back to ancient tech for modern problems. Terracotta is a 3,000-year-old solution to fighting extreme heat. Shows how this ancient material, terracotta, with its natural cooling properties, is being cleverly adapted today as a sustainable, electricity-free way to cool buildings. Passive cooling.
It's brilliant, really. Terracotta is porous. Water evaporates from it, which cools it down. It also has thermal mass. This company in Delhi, Ant Studio, has this project called Coolant. They use these terracotta cones or modules as a kind of second skin on concrete buildings in India. And they're seeing average temperature drops of 6 to 8 degrees Celsius. It works better in drier climates where evaporation is more effective. Research suggests it could cut AC use by up to 70% in some places.
And even a few degrees makes a big difference. It helps our bodies cool down more efficiently indoors, which directly translates to lower mortality rates during heat waves. It's a sustainable alternative to power-hungry air conditioning, which is becoming critical as the world warms, especially in places without reliable electricity. Makes you think, doesn't it? How ancient wisdom combined with modern design can offer these elegant, sustainable solutions, making our homes more comfortable, more eco-friendly, without just cranking up the AC.
Now let's turn to a very human challenge, addressed in Ways to Cope When Your Child Gets a Life-Altering Diagnosis. This research by Beth S. Russell offers really practical coping strategies for parents facing that immense distress and burden. Strategies focused on flexibility, joy, and community.
Yeah, Russell talks about her experience in a neonatal intensive care unit, seeing parents grappling with pain, loss, anxiety, asking that heartbreaking question, what am I supposed to do now? The demands on caregivers can be overwhelming, sacrificing their own health, facing increased anxiety and depression, lower life satisfaction. Plus, there's often this uncertainty, no clear roadmap for their child's future, especially independence.
So Russell highlights three key coping skills. First is flexibility, being lightly committed to any given solution. Knowing you might have to pivot, change strategies constantly. What worked yesterday might not work today. She gives her own example of having to constantly adjust her exercise routine. Second is joy, actively seeking out quick touch points that make us smile. Simple things, a favorite song, a soft shirt, planning a nice meal, and emphasizing shared moments of joy with the child, however small. And third, community. Building diverse support networks, having people for reliable everyday help, and others who are good in a real crisis. Both online and in-person communities are valuable. These are really universal coping skills, aren't they? For anyone facing major life challenges, a reminder that seeking support, finding joy, these aren't luxuries. They're necessities for getting through it.
Absolutely. And sticking with human connection, how nostalgia keeps friendships alive, offers a fascinating insight. It suggests that nostalgia, which is often really about social memories, acts as a kind of psychological resource. It actively helps us maintain and strengthen our friendships, especially as we get older.
That rings true for me. When I get nostalgic, it's almost always about people, right? Family times, old school friends, trips. Even if it's triggered by an object, the memory is usually about sharing it with someone. The article mentions a study during COVID lockdowns. People turned to nostalgic music, old TV shows, familiar games that evoked social connection when they were feeling isolated. And a survey found that people who were naturally more prone to nostalgia actually had more people in their innermost friendship circle. They were also more motivated to keep up their social networks, regardless of personality traits like being extroverted.
Yeah, the research suggests nostalgia fuels social motivation, both meeting new people and strengthening existing ties, but especially strengthening the ones you already have. And here's the really interesting part. Normally, our close social networks tend to shrink as we age. It's just a common pattern. But Dutch data showed that people high in nostalgia proneness managed to maintain a relatively stable number of close networks over 7 years. They counteracted that typical decline. So nostalgia isn't just passive reminiscing. It's serving this active social function. It's an emotional signal that guides us to reflect on what truly matters in our relationships. Makes you think, doesn't it? Maybe taking a moment to reminisce, maybe even sharing those memories with old friends, is a powerful way to nurture those connections and build a more resilient social life.
Okay, finally in this section we have Public Education Needs Our Support. This is Scientific American's editorial piece for the issue. And they take a very strong stance, arguing that public education in the U.S. is under attack in ways that threaten critical thinking, scientific innovation, and even democracy itself.
The editorial lays out a range of threats. Funding cuts, diverting money to private school vouchers, curriculum battles, book bans, especially around topics like climate science, slavery, race, gender identity. They draw parallels to historical fights like the Scopes trial over evolution 100 years ago or ongoing battles in states like Texas over textbooks.
The core argument is powerful. They state that efforts to quell and control taxpayer-funded education is antithetical to a society that values evidence and knowledge. They call it a concerted effort in thought control, racism, classism, and sexism. Strong words. The impact, they argue, goes beyond the classroom. Undermining critical thinking and exposure to diverse ideas hurts creativity, innovation, and ultimately, the U.S.'s standing in the world.
They also critique voucher programs specifically, pointing to issues like Arizona's system draining public funds or initial drops in test scores for voucher students in Indiana, and the fact that in many rural areas, private schools just aren't an option anyway. The editorial calls for appropriate funding, not just bare minimums. Higher teacher salaries, better facilities, reliable transport, comprehensive textbooks, good labs, more course options, trades, training, preschool, mental and physical health support, nutritious meals, after-school programs, the whole package. The message for you, the listener, is clear. Supporting robust public education is vital, not just for kids, but for fostering the next generation of scientists, innovators, critical thinkers, essential for a healthy democracy and society.
All right, let's shift our gaze outwards again to cosmic exploration and some fundamental mysteries, starting with, in the search for life beyond Earth, the only constant is hope. This piece really captures the long, often frustrating, but always hopeful search for extraterrestrial life, a real roller coaster, as they put it.
It's a story full of dashed hopes and renewed optimism, isn't it? You had Percival Lowell in the late 1800s, convinced he saw canals on Mars built by an intelligent civilization based on a mistranslation of Schiaparelli's canal ear channels. That whole dream of advanced Martians died with the first close-up images from Mariner 4 in 1965 showing a barren, cratered world. Then you have Enrico Fermi's famous question from 1950, if life is likely, where is everybody? The Great Silence, early SETI searches like Frank Drake's Project Ozma listening for radio signals in 1960, or that tantalizing YOW signal in 1977 that was never heard again. Lots of searching, no confirmed contact from ET.
But the game completely changed with exoplanets, didn't it? First discovery around a pulsar in 92 by Wolsan and Frail. Then the Kepler mission starting in 2009 just opened the floodgates. Thousands of worlds discovered, over 5,900 confirmed now. It proved planets are the norm, not the exception. That massively boosted the odds in the drink equation, which tries to estimate how many civilizations might be out there. Suddenly, life seems statistically much more plausible.
And crucially, our definition of where life could exist has expanded dramatically thanks to extremophiles. Thomas Brock finding bacteria thriving in Yellowstone's boiling springs in 66 was just the start. Now we know life exists in deep sea vents, toxic mine waste, radioactive water, incredibly harsh places. So primitive life, microbial life, could plausibly survive in places we never considered before, like the hidden oceans of Jupiter's moon Europa, or the geysers on Saturn's moon Enceladus, or maybe even in subsurface water pockets on Mars. We have good reason to think simple life might be out there. What would finding even single-celled organisms elsewhere mean to you? It really taps into our deepest human curiosity about our place in the cosmos, doesn't it?
Absolutely. Now, speaking of Jupiter, let's dive into how NASA's Juno probe changed everything we know about Jupiter. This mission's just been incredible. It rewrote the story on Jupiter, revealing a planet far stranger and more complex than we ever imagined, forcing scientists to toss out old models.
Juno's been a workhorse. Survived that insane radiation environment way longer than expected, finally ending its extended mission this month, September 2025. Earlier probes like Voyager and Galileo gave us snapshots, but Juno was designed to pierce the clouds, measure gravity precisely, withstand the radiation with its titanium vault, really get deep insights. They even added JunoCam for public outreach, not originally a science instrument, but it gave us those stunning close-up images.
And the surprises just kept coming. Those bizarre geometric storms at the poles, an octagon of storms at the north, a pentagon at the south, each bigger than the U.S. And they're weirdly stable. Scientists are still scratching their heads. Are you sure you got the right planet? One apparently asked. The Great Red Spot, not just a surface storm. It goes down 300 miles. That's 55 times deeper than Mount Everest is tall. And the lightning. Juno found this weird high-altitude lightning in freezing cold regions. Turns out ammonia acts like antifreeze, creating slushy droplets that generate the charge, a type of lightning totally unknown on Earth.
And the ammonia mystery. They expected Jupiter's atmosphere to be well-mixed, like a whisked egg, but Juno found these deep wells 90 miles down, almost completely lacking ammonia. That led to the mushballs theory, basically. Ammonia-rich slush balls, maybe softball-sized, encased in ice, plunging deep into the planet before melting and releasing the ammonia lower down. Juno's microwave data confirmed it. Amazing detective work. Jupiter's magnetic field is also completely bonkers, lopsided, way bigger than thought reaches Saturn, with this intense great blue spot. And it's generated by metallic hydrogen, not molten metal like Earth's.
But the core? That might be the biggest shocker. The thinking was either the small, dense, rocky core, or basically no core at all. Juno found neither. It's a fuzzy core. Probably solid, but it just sort of blends gradually into the metallic hydrogen layer above it, not distinct layers like Earth. Steve Levin from the Juno team admitted, "We frankly don't know how to explain that."
And another puzzle. Jupiter has way more heavy elements than the Sun, 3 or 4 times more. But they're mostly found higher up in the atmosphere, not sunk down in the core where gravity should pull them. Theories. Maybe a giant impact smashed an early solid core and mixed everything up. Or maybe our physics just doesn't fully grasp conditions that extreme. Juno also gave us incredible looks at the moons. Io, the volcanic moon. Juno found no trace of the shallow magma ocean previously suspected. Maybe it's a maze of rock tunnels instead. And Juno caught the biggest eruption ever seen on Io, starting last December, lava covering 40,000 square miles, releasing more energy than all of humanity uses in a year. And it's still going.
Juno's legacy is just immense, rewriting planet formation theories, proving out radiation shielding for future missions. For you, it's just a stunning example of how exploring these distant worlds forces us to confront how little we know, sparks new questions, and showcases incredible human ingenuity.
From Jupiter, a quick hop over to its ringed neighbor. Saturn has 274 known moons, thanks in large part to this astronomer. This highlights the work of Edward Ashton, who helped find 192 of Saturn's now mind-boggling total of 274 known moons. Saturn is officially the solar system's moon king.
That number jump is incredible. A decade ago, it was 62 moons, now 274. Ashton used this clever shifting and stacking technique with telescope images, looking for faint moving dots near Saturn, then tracking them over months or years to confirm they were actually orbiting. Apparently, the technique wasn't brand new, but it's super time-consuming, especially because Saturn's gravitational reach covers a huge area of the sky to search.
Right now, we mostly just know their orbits and rough sizes, but the way they're clustered suggests many are fragments from past collisions between larger parent moons, gives us clues about the system's history. Saturn seems unique in having so many small, irregular moons. Maybe from a relatively recent collision that shattered something big. And there could be more discoveries coming, especially with new telescopes like the Nancy Grace Roman Space Telescope. It's amazing how much is still out there to find, even in our own backyard. These tiny moons telling stories of cosmic violence.
Okay, next up, hypervelocity stars hint at a nearby supermassive black hole. This is cool. Studying stars moving at insane speeds millions of kilometers per hour is providing strong evidence for a dormant supermassive black hole in the Large Magellanic Cloud, the LMC, our neighboring galaxy.
Right. We know most big galaxies have a supermassive black hole, SMBH, at their center. But the LMC is smaller, a dwarf galaxy, and it doesn't have that bright glow of an active feeding black hole, so it was a question mark. Hypervelocity stars are the key. These stars get ejected, usually from near an SMBH. A binary star system gets too close. One star falls in or gets captured. The other gets flung out at incredible speed, sometimes fast enough to escape the galaxy entirely. Our own Milky Way's black hole, Sagittarius A, definitely launches some of these.
So researchers used super precise data from the Gaia Space Observatory positions, distances, velocities for 21 known hypervelocity stars way out on the edge of the Milky Way. They traced their paths backward and found that 9 of them likely originated from the direction of the Large Magellanic Cloud. Our satellite galaxy is shooting stars at us, as the article puts it. By modeling how massive a black hole would need to be to launch stars that fast, they estimated the LMC's SMBH is about 600,000 times the mass of our Sun, which fits nicely with the LMC being a smaller galaxy. It helps scientists figure out how small a galaxy can be and still host an SMBH. And yeah, maybe watch out for those intergalactic stellar bullets. It shows how astronomers use these weird phenomena to find hidden giants.
Okay, from the cosmic back down to the fundamental, this time in computing. New proof dramatically compresses space needed for computation. This is a huge theoretical breakthrough by MIT's Ryan Williams. He proved that solving a problem that takes 10 steps in time only needs roughly the square root of bits of memory. That completely changes decades of assumptions.
Wow. Okay, so the old thinking was basically time and space scale together, right? If a calculation takes 100 times longer, you need about 100 times more memory to store the intermediate steps. But Williams proved it's not linear. 100 times the steps only needs about 10 times the memory, the square root. He said the old intuition was completely false. It involves this clever mathematical trick called reduction, transforming the problem into an equivalent one you can solve by reusing memory space incredibly efficiently, packing the information into way fewer bits.
It's seen as unbelievable progress in computational complexity theory, challenges the whole idea of a direct trade-off between time and space. As Williams puts it, the real constraint is not how much memory we have, but how wisely we use it. This could eventually lead to way more efficient algorithms, maybe even new computer architectures. For you, it's a sign that even the theoretical limits of computing are being rethought, which ultimately impacts all the technology we rely on.
And speaking of fundamental proofs, lofty math problem called Hilbert's So the Closer to Being Solved. This reports on a major step towards solving one of David Gilbert's famous 23 problems from 1900. Mathematicians have unified three different physical theories describing fluid motion.
Hilbert's problems really set the agenda for 20th century math. The sixth problem was about axiomatizing physics, giving it a rigorous mathematical foundation. For fluids like water or air, you have different ways to describe their motion. Microscopic, Newton's laws for individual particles, like tiny billiard balls bouncing around. Massoscopic, the Boltzmann equation, looking statistically at the probable behavior of a typical particle. Macroscopic, equations like Euler or Navier-Stokes, treating the fluid as a smooth, continuous substance. The challenge was to prove mathematically that these levels build logically on each other, that the macroscopic view emerges rigorously from the mesoscopic, which emerges from the microscopic. Previous proofs had limitations, like only working for short times or in a vacuum.
But these mathematicians, Deng, Hani, and Mach, they managed to derive the mesoscopic Boltzmann equation from the microscopic Newtonian laws. They did it by looking at what happens as you have infinite particles of zero size. A key breakthrough was figuring out how to make it work over any length of time, accounting for all the past collisions. By combining this with earlier work linking the mesoscopic to the macroscopic, they've essentially unified the whole picture for fluids.
It mathematically justifies the equations we use, strengthens our confidence in them, and might open doors for similar unifications in other areas of physics. For you, it shows how deep abstract math underpins the science we use every day, from weather forecasts to designing airplanes. Okay, one last deep dive. Literally under our feet. North America may be dripping away deep under the Midwest. New seismic research suggests an ancient sunken geological plate might be pulling molten rock off the bottom of the North American continent's core, eroding it from below.
That sounds alarming. Cratons, the ancient cores of continents like ours, are supposed to be super stable, right? Billions of years old, nigh eternal.
Okay.
But the team, led by Yunlin Hua, used a new high-resolution technique, analyzing seismic waves from thousands of sensors across North America. They mapped remnants of the Farallon Plate, an old oceanic plate mostly pushed under North America millions of years ago. But pieces are still down there, deep in the mantle, about 800 kilometers down to the Midwest.
And their computer models showed something fascinating. The Farallon slab, being dense, acts like a big sinker. It seems to be pulling material off the bottom of the much older, lighter North American craton, like dripping candle wax, but with rock over geological time. Other geologists are intrigued but want more evidence, like seeing the surface being pulled down too, or a better explanation for how the lighter craton rock gets dragged into the denser mantle. But it points to a much more dynamic continent than we thought. The continent is not something static, it has a dynamic component. For you, it's just another reminder that even the solid ground we stand on is constantly, slowly, mysteriously changing, shaped by forces deep within the Earth.
Okay, let's wrap up with a quick look at science history and the bigger picture presented in the issue. First, the editorial, 180 years of standing up for science. It's by the new editor-in-chief, David M. Ewald, celebrating the magazine's long history and reaffirming its mission.
Yeah, Ewald shares his own story inspired by Carl Sagan, shuttle launches, the Human Genome Project. He connects it back to Scientific American's founder, Rufus Porter, promising in 1845 to instruct while it diverts or amuses. And he argues that mission is more crucial than ever now, facing hostility like climate denial, vaccine misinformation, cuts to science funding, even top researchers thinking of leaving the U.S. He frames this anniversary issue, with all its stories of scientific U-turns and progress, like the peanut allergy article, as examples of why advocating for science, making it accessible and understandable, is so vital. For you, it's a moment to reflect on the importance of science journalism, of standing up for evidence and knowledge, especially when things get challenging.
And finally, just a quick peek into the past with September 2025, science history from 50, 100, and 150 years ago. Always fun to see what they were talking about then.
Right. In 1975, 50 years ago, Carl Sagan was writing about space probes as Earth fires seeds into space, humanity entering this new age of exploration. Go back 100 years, 1925, C. Francis Jenkins was demonstrating early television via radio, sending moving pictures 5 miles, predicting we'd watch baseball and prize fights on it someday. And 150 years ago, 1875, Professor J.S. Newberry was describing this huge armor-plated fossil fish, Deinonychus torelli, that ruled the seas. Gives you that perspective.
It really does. Shows how fast science moves, how yesterday's sci-fi becomes today's reality, but also how some big questions just keep driving us forward.
Exactly. That constant unfolding of understanding.
Okay, well, we have covered an incredible amount of ground today. What a deep dive into the September 2025 Scientific American. We've gone from Jupiter's bizarre storms and fuzzy core down to the intricate dance of RNA in our cells, the way cells might even respond to sound. We've seen science overturning centuries of dogma about nerve regrowth, uncovering the brain's nightly cleaning system, and offering real hope for things like peanut allergies. It really underscores how science is this dynamic, evolving process, constantly challenging what we thought we knew. Thank you so much for joining us on this exploration.
And as we've seen again and again today, the universe, life itself, it just keeps revealing itself to be far more complex, more dynamic, more surprising than we ever assumed. It really requires a certain humility, doesn't it? And it makes me pose a final question for you, the listener. If science is constantly changing its mind, constantly revealing these new layers of reality, what unassailable facts in your own understanding of the world, your own assumptions, might be the next ones to be rewritten, something to ponder? Thank you for joining us on this deep dive into discovery.